everybody knows, I think, who Rebecca is, but they buy it in a sense, and it's a pleasure to have her back here. Rebecca, as you know, grew up in Toronto, won the Chidon HaTanach here. She taught, I think, in the people at she trained people in Chidon, has a degree in neuroscience, a master. She was in the GPATH program at Stern, the graduate program in Talmudic studies for women. She taught the first mother and daughter bat mitzvah program that we ran at Torah Moshe, the Matan program. Rebecca was our teacher, and she spends her time both in the best of the Torah mother world, half in Torah, half in Matan. Now her and her husband are back in New York, and we figured we'd do an experiment, do a Motzei Shabbat Yomini Beit Midrash for men and women, and with that, I'll let her take over.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelly. Okay. This is a little... Okay. Well, thank you so, so much for coming out tonight on a Motzei Shabbos, like Rabbi Kelman said. I really appreciate it. It's great to see everybody here, and it's really nice to be back in Toronto. And tonight, I thought we would talk a little bit about models of Kibud Av V'Em in the Tanakh. And I wanted to just start off by talking about how the Gemara approaches Kibud Av V'Em, because I think that's where we get kind of most of our ideas of what Kibud Av V'Em is about. Sorry. Thank you. Most of our ideas of what Kibud Av V'Em is about and what really embodies the mitzvah from what we see from the discussions that we see in the Gemara. And really, Kibud Av V'Em is mentioned three different times in the Torah. I'm sure many of you know. It's written in the Aseret Hadibrot twice, because the Aseret Hadibrot appear twice in the Torah. So, Kabed et Avicha ve'et Imecha is mentioned in Shmot, and it's also mentioned in Dvarim. And we also see that Kibud Av V'Em, the mitzvah of honoring your parents, is also mentioned in Sefer Vayikra, in Parsha Kedoshim, Ishima v'Aviv Tira'u, that we also have to fear our parents. And the Gemara kind of takes both of these commandments and puts them together as Kavod and Yira. So fearing your parents and also honoring your parents. And those two different commandments together make up the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em that we call it today. So this is going to be kind of a semi-informal type of Beit Midrash session, like Rabbi Kalman said. So what I'd like everyone to do is just read source number one by themselves, or kind of in a chavruta or in a group, however you'd like, just source number one, which is the initial Gemara to describe the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. And if you want, you can kind of pay attention to a few of the questions below, and then we'll regroup and we'll discuss this Gemara together. Okay, so please go ahead, read that first Gemara by yourselves, and we'll come back. Okay, so how's everyone doing? This is a relatively short first source, so I think we can come back and just talk about it briefly together. Okay, so this is the Gemara in Kiddushin, Daf Lamed Aleph, Amud Bet, and it's the Braita that talks about what we were just saying before, the two different commandments of Kibud Av V'Em, Kavod and Yira. So I think everybody read it by themselves. And did anybody figure out or see what the difference was, the main difference that the Gemara really shows? What's the main difference between the way it describes Kavod and the way that it describes Yira? Any ideas? Yes. Physically caring for the parent, whereas Yira... More of a show of honor is Yira. Okay, interesting. Very nice. Anything else that anyone can see? Yeah, Ahuva. Mm-hmm. Right, very nice. Okay, so just building on, sorry, what's your name again? Toby was saying, is that it seems like Yira is more of a lotase type of mitzvah that it, as it's presented in the Gemara, whereas kavod is more of an ase, right? So we're doing things for our parents through kavod, and through yira we're not doing things. We're just stopping ourselves from doing things. Lo yashev bimkama, lo sater tzvarav. It's something that we're not supposed to be doing. And actually, Rabbi Willig points out very eloquently, Rabbi Willig, who's one of the, he teaches in YU, I think he's one of the Rosh Yeshiva, thank you. He says that it's much easier to keep the yira part of Kibud Av V'Em once we leave our parents' homes. right? And that makes a lot of sense, because if I'm not in my parents' house, it's really easy for me not to sit in their chair. That makes a lot of sense. Whereas the kavod aspect is something that's always kind of incumbent upon us. That's something that's always kind of hanging over us, that we always have to do whether we're living in their house or not. And even though the Gemara really tries to very clearly lay out for us the rules of how we're supposed to conduct ourselves in the kavod aspect and in the yira aspect, really, obviously, it's much more complicated than that. And just to take, for example, one of the phrases in the kavod, in the mora side, it says, v'lo soter et barav, that we're not allowed to contradict our parents. Okay? And we can take that kind of very literally, and we can say, literally, if my parents said something, I'm not allowed to say, no, Mom, I disagree with you. Or we can take that, maybe we can take that a little bit more generally. Let's say I know that my parents would disagree with something that I was going to do. Let's say I know that my parents hold a belief that I don't necessarily agree with, and then I go out and I do that thing, or I go against what I know that my parent inherently would not want me to do. Is that also, does that also fall under v'lo soter et barav? Okay, so it could be much more complicated than what's kind of, simply laid out for us in the Gemara. Does everybody see that? Okay. So what else do we have here? Okay, great. So that's source number one, and that's source number one. I just wanted to kind of lay out for you and show you how the Gemara talks about Kavod and Yira, or the general mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. And what the Gemara is trying to do, while these examples are really very practical instructions for our everyday lives, when we really look through the Tanakh and we try to find different characters who maybe emulate these instructions or emulate how the Gemara tells us to behave towards our parents, we're really very hard-pressed to find any character in the Tanakh that really we can point to and say, oh yes, this character really emulates the way the Gemara describes Kavod, or this character really emulates the way that the Gemara describes Yira. We're really very hard-pressed to find that. So I think what would be interesting and what we're going to do tonight is we're going to explore two very specific father-son relationships and see how some of the rules are applied in very different situations in the Tanakh and how they're applied perhaps very imperfectly in the Tanakh and how maybe we can learn something about Kibud Av V'Em in a very different way from the way that we would learn it in the Gemara. And the first relationship that we're going to talk about today is the relationship between Yaakov Avinu, and two of his sons, specifically Shimon and Levi. And we're going to start off by reading the story in Chavruta, which is source number two. We're going to read the very famous story of Yaakov and his sons, of Dina. And the story of Dina, since we're starting a little bit later on in the story, I'll just give a quick background for those who aren't familiar. Basically, Dina is taken in by a man named Shechem ben Hamor, and he sleeps with her, and she is essentially raped by him. And obviously, Yaakov and his sons are very, very upset about this, and they're not sure how to deal with the situation, with what happened to Dina, Yaakov's daughter. So I'd like everybody to read parts of this parak by themselves, and try the main question that I'd like you to try to figure out and see what's going on here is, how does the Torah approach Yaakov's son's actions? How does the Torah approach the way that Shimon and Levi reacted to this situation with Dina? So I'd like everybody to read this story in Chavruta, and we'll come back and discuss it together. Okay? Go ahead. Okay, let's regroup. Let's discuss this source, okay? So this is source number two. We're talking about the story of Yaakov and Dina and Shimon and Levi and their reaction to what happened to Dina. And the main question that I asked everybody to think about was, what is the Torah's perspective on the way that Shimon and Levi reacted? Yes. Okay, which verse are you talking about? That That's okay. Are you talking about the last pasuk lamed aleph, vayamru hakazona ya'aser achotenu? How can we let our sister be a harlot? Okay. Okay. Nivala asavi Israel. Okay, so something disgusting was done in Israel, and therefore what you're saying is that the Torah clearly sides on the side of Shimon and Levi, that the entire city has to be destroyed. And your proof comes from the discussion that Yaakov's sons had, how there was a Nivala asavi Israel. Okay, great. One opinion. Anyone else? How does the Torah, what is the Torah's perspective on Shimon and Levi's actions? Anyone? What do we think? Yes, Josh.
It does let them get the last word.
Very good. Excellent. They end off. Keep going. Sorry. Okay. Vayomru hakazona ya'aser achotenu. So Yaakov rebukes them in Pasuk Lamed. He gets angry at them and he says, Achartem ati, you completely embarrassed me, you disgusted me, you made me seem disgusting in the eyes of all the nations around me. And the Torah could have ended there, but instead the Torah goes on and allows Shimon and Levi to get the last word in and say, Hakazona ya'aser achotenu, yeah, but Dad, how could we let this continue? How can we let this go on? How can we let our sister be a harlot? Beautiful. Okay, that's a similar perspective, though. Yes. Okay, so you're siding still with Shimon and Levi, that the Torah thinks that what Shimon and Levi did was positive, was good. Anybody think that the Torah disagrees with Shimon and Levi? Doesn't like what Shimon and Levi did? Yep. Yeah, sure. That God is upset. Very true, but we're talking, right, true. God is not really here in this text at all. It's completely a discussion of just people. And, yeah.
The text,
ah, but that's really the discussion of, that's the brothers. Ubnei Yaakov ba umin hasadeh. Right, right, that's the brother's opinion, exactly. Okay, go ahead. You can get a comment. Yes.
I think the Torah is neutral. It's telling the story, showing what the two sides said. I don't see them siding with one side.
No, right. So you're saying the Torah is completely neutral. They're just giving a narrative, and it's kind of up to us to pass judgment. Do we think it's right or do we think it's wrong? Okay, that's fair also. Esther, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Clearly not a bracha. Beautiful. So Esther, we're going to stop for a second. And thank you, Esther, for bringing that up. We're going to read the source in Bereishit 49. Does everybody see that, Mem Tet? Which is the time that Yaakov is blessing his sons. And he's supposed to be blessing all of his sons. But instead, as Esther beautifully pointed out, when he gives the blessing to Shimon and Levi, instead, it's more of a curse. So we'll read it together. Shimon v'Levi achim klei chamas mecherotehem, b'sodam al tavo nafshi, b'kalam al tached kvodi, ki be'apam hargu ish, u'birtsonam ikru shor. Okay? So that's pretty harsh. And Yaakov goes on the next page, arur apam, ki az ve'evratam ki kashata, achalakem b'Yaakov v'afitzem b'Yisrael. Okay, so everyone can read the English translation. Cursed be their anger. Yaakov is really upset at the way that they were so zealous. They let their anger get to them. For it was fierce in their wrath. It was cruel what they did. And therefore, I will divide them in Yaakov and I will scatter them among the people in Israel. So as Esther points out, obviously there's something about the actions of Shimon and Levi that the Torah views as very negative, or at least someone can also turn around and say that Yaakov views is very negative, and he holds this anger for all this time, and on his deathbed, he turns around to Shimon and Levi, and instead of kind of being able to reconcile the differences that they had, he's still really angry at them, and he still says, and still, instead of giving them a blessing, he essentially curses them. Arur apam. Yes. It's clearly... Shevet Levi, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's Shevet Levi. Very nice. And maybe even earlier the Torah would agree with you. Okay, yeah. Anyone else? David, yeah? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, beautiful. So David's pointing to the other pasuk that we brought in that happens a little bit after the story of the people of, after the story of Shechem and Hamor, which is Bereshit Lamed Hey, and everyone can see that. Thank you, David. And it says, when it talks about Yaakov and his family traveling around, it says, Vayisau, Vayhi Chitat Elohim al Ha'arim Asher Svivotehem, V'lo Radfu Acharei Bnei Yaakov. So after this story of Shimon and Levi going and attacking Shechem, the result, even though Yaakov was very nervous about what had happened, and he was nervous about maybe what you're saying tactically, he was nervous how the different nations were going to react to what Shimon and Levi did. Instead, it seems that everybody around them was very scared of them, and they didn't want to mess with Bnei Yisrael anymore. And it seems, as David's pointing out, that the Torah really here is siding with how Shimon and Levi acted, is siding with their actions, because essentially it strengthened Yaakov and his brothers instead of what Yaakov was afraid of, which was that it was going to weaken them. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And once they found out what had happened, mm-hmm. they were going to react in a pretty violent manner.
Okay, what would give you that indication? How would he have known that?
Did he have to, I don't know, by knowing the personalities of his son.
Okay.
So he never stopped them. I mean, mm-hmm. he certainly didn't have a problem with them finding out what had happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if he lit the fuse, and then whatever was going to happen was going to happen, and he didn't try and
he didn't really intervene. Okay, possibly. And actually, we have this discussion that we're having actually is a machloket Ramban, and about whether or not the Torah sides, whether or not Shimon and Levi's actions are justified or whether they should be condemned. And many contemporary critics talk about how here Yaakov is, in this entire story as you're talking about, Yaakov is very, very passive. And they criticize Yaakov for being a very passive leader in this story, where Shimon and Levi understood what had to be done. Yaakov, as you're saying, kind of stood by the wayside and just didn't do anything. Okay? Maybe he was standing by the wayside because he just wanted to let it happen. But interesting that he got very angry at them and then never reconciled that anger. Okay. A couple more comments, and then we're going to move on. Yes, Beth.
There was no consultation ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
The whole discussion takes place after they took the action. But there was no, this is a sure about
you. Yes, beautiful, yeah.
So, they violated it on many levels.
Yes.
First of all, there was no consultation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He was embarrassed by the breaking the deal. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, that was, and finally, as a final kind of slap in the face, they talked back to their father.
Mm-hmm.
The last word was really kind of insulting
Beautiful, right? And that's another way where whereas Josh was saying that ending off with HaKazonaya said Achotenu, allowing Shimon and Levi to have the last word. Josh was saying before that that shows that the Torah sides with Shimon and Levi. What Zev is perhaps saying is that it's actually the opposite. Here, the Torah is showing us how chutzpahic Shimon and Levi really were. It's really bringing out their personality. It's really showing their chutzpah. Their father just rebuked them, and they still have the chutzpah to turn around and say, yeah, well, you know, but we still disagree with you. Right? Very interesting. Beautiful. Yeah. Of power. So you think that maybe. Excellent. Okay, how about one more comment, and then we're going to move on, if that's okay. One more. Ellen, go ahead.
I think it's fascinating. If you read this whole thing, and it sounds like Shimon and Levi are like Bosley twins.
Okay.
Working together, they're doing the same thing, and Yaakov says Shimon and Levi are famous. Mm-hmm. And these guys are like the same mind, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, Rabbi Kelman points out Shimon and Levi become the leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And Shimon is just right there.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes diametrically opposite faith, yet they both build on land.
Right, yeah, that's a... Which is kind of hinted to in this Arur, right. It is very ambiguous. It is very difficult to really know what the Torah is thinking. But what we do know for sure, and as Zev pointed out, what we're concentrating on today, is that we know that Yaakov was very, very angry at them. He was very angry at their actions, and he was angry enough that even though perhaps the other nations did look towards Bnei Yisrael, did look towards Bnei Yaakov in fear. And maybe there was something positive that came out of the actions of Shimon and Levi. Regardless of that, Yaakov hung on to his anger of Shimon and Levi for years and years and years and years until his deathbed, when he finally blurts out to them, instead of blurting out a blessing, he essentially curses them. And so obviously there was something very rotten about that relationship. And I'd like everyone just to keep that in mind, the relationship between Yaakov and his sons. Hang on. We'll get to questions afterwards because I want to move on to the next source, the next relationship that we're going to talk about. Everyone just keep this one in mind. We're going to move on to another very different relationship that happens in Nach, in Shmuel Aleph, the relationship between Yehonatan and his father Shaul HaMelech. Shaul, the first king of Israel. And I'd like everybody to read this source together. This is source number 3, and I've tried to cut it a little bit short. You can just stop when you get to the questions, because we'll do the other sources together. And I'm just going to give a quick background to this, okay? So the war that we're going to be reading about, the story that we'll be reading about with Yehonatan and Shaul, is actually the first war that Shaul is fighting against the Plishtim. And Shaul was fighting with the Plishtim for basically all of Shmuel Aleph. And this is the first war that we see Shaul fighting with the Plishtim. And this war starts immediately after the first time that Shaul did not listen to Shmuel HaNavi. Shmuel HaNavi told Shaul, I'd like you to wait for me to be Zaveach Zevach, to sacrifice this specific korban before going to war. I'd like you to wait for me for a certain amount of time. And Shaul is getting antsy. He's with the nation. Everybody's waiting around for Shmuel. And Shmuel's not showing up. And Shaul just disregards what Shmuel said, and he sacrifices the korban. Okay, so this story is happening immediately after that story where Shaul doesn't listen to Shmuel, and Shmuel tells Shaul, because you didn't listen to me, eventually the melucha, eventually the kingship, is going to be taken out of your hands. And now we meet Shaul and Yehonatan, who are going to, immediately before they fight with the Plishtim. Okay, so I'd like everybody to read these sources together and think about the relationship between Shaul and his son, Yehonatan. Go ahead. Okay, so let's just come back for a quick discussion about these psukim that we read about Shaul and Yehonatan and the war against the Plishtim. Okay, So everybody caught where Yohanan disobeys his father Shaul. Did everyone catch that part? Where was that? How did Yonatan disobey his father? By eating from the honey, exactly. And as we had somebody point out in the midst of the Chavruta, if everybody reads the Psukim carefully, right, you can go back to Pasu Kaf Zayin, right? The Yohanatan lo shama behashpia vivet ha'am. Pardon? He didn't know, right? He didn't know what his father had said because they were in two separate parts of the war. But then what happens? He finds out that his father said no one's allowed to eat all day. And then what does he say? Then he says, well, I'm really happy that I ate because my father was an idiot. What was my father thinking, right? He in fact says, achar avi et ha'aretz, which is pretty harsh, right? My father disgraced the land. What was my father thinking? If everybody would be eating, everybody would have as much energy as I had. Okay, so we had two questions. Let's just talk about them quickly. Why does Yohanan disobey his father? Any thoughts? He wasn't aware. Okay, but then why does he disobey? Why is he happy about his disobedience? Yeah, David. Okay. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Okay, so he was the one who was in charge of the war. He's the one who incited the war. He's the one. It was his idea. He started the whole thing. And all of the, any more losses that they would accrue would ultimately, he would think, fall to him. And why does Shaul then not kill Yohanan? Yeah. Yes. Beautiful. Excellent. Okay, Shaul's personality throughout Shmuel Aleph he tries to please the people. He's a people pleaser, Shaul. And here too, we see that the people convinced Shaul, even though Yohanan was effectively Mored B'Malchut, not just going against you as his father, but going against you as his king, even though he was Mored B'Malchut, since the people love Yohanan, Shaul says, well, the people love Yohanan, so I'm going to go along with that. And that ultimately saves Yohanan's life. Now, Yohanan, up until now, is in some ways, we'll talk about it in a second, we'll talk about it right now actually, the story is very reminiscent in many ways to the story that we read about Yaakov with Shimon and Levi. In both cases, we have fathers who are very, very passive, right? Shaul is not the one who started the war, and neither is Yaakov against the people of Shechem. In both cases, we have sons who decide that they're going to take action against the enemy. Shimon and Levi taking action against Shechem, and Yohanan taking action against the Plishtim, possibly against their father's will, or without their father knowing. Okay, in both cases, their father, their parents don't know that they are going out to battle, that they're going out against the enemy. In both cases, their fathers are very, very angry at their actions. And in both cases, we have this very interesting verb that Ellen pointed out is achar. Did everyone notice that? Right? In the story of Shimon and Levi, Yaakov says, achartem oti. Okay? So you defiled me, you disgraced me. And in the story of Yohanan and Shaul, Yohanan says, achar avier haaretz. My father defiled or disgraced the land. Yes. And they're both beautiful. Okay, very nice. another great comparison. Okay, the difference between the stories comes in the next part that I'm just going to ask you to do very, very quickly in Chavruta together, is the way that their relationships, the relationship between Yohanan and Shaul, ends very, very differently from the way that the relationship between Shimon and Levi's relationship with Yaakov ends at the end of Yaakov's life. The end of Yaakov's life, we know that Yaakov remains very, very angry at Shimon and Levi, whereas at the end of Shaul's life, his relationship with Yohanan is very different. I'd like you to turn to the next few sources after the questions, okay, so starting from Shmuel Aleph Yudchet. These are all sources that have to do with the way that Shaul and Yehonatan felt about David HaMelech. Okay, so this is a little bit later on in Shmuel Aleph, after Shaul is already very, very nervous about what David HaMelech is going to do to his kingship, to his Melucha. So I'd like you to read those sources all the way through to, all the way through to source number 4. And we'll come back and discuss those together. Go ahead. Okay, so let's discuss these next few sources, okay? The sources that are talking about Yonatan and Shaul and their relationship with David. And if you look through the sources, I'm sure you all have, because I asked you to. So if you look through the sources, a few people already pointed out really nicely that, firstly, many of the sources are from this week's Haftorah, Machar Chodesh. So kudos to those of you who noticed that. And so it should be all... this should be very familiar to everybody. But also, if we look at the sources, obviously we all know that Yonatan loves David and Shaul hates David. David is Shaul's mortal enemy until the end. So we know that there's an obvious disagreement in the way that both Shaul and Yonatan and their relationship with David. Yehonatan very much disagrees with Shaul, and Shaul disagrees with Yehonatan in his treatment of David. And Yehonatan, interestingly, goes through a number of phases in order to accept the fact that his father really, really hates David. Does everybody notice those phases? Starts off really with denial, right? Yehonatan cannot believe David says to Yonatan, your father wants to kill me. Yonatan says, no, he would never want to kill you. He would have told me. He would never harm anybody. What are you talking about? Right? Everyone notice that? Okay? Then Yonatan progresses and he tries to reason with his father, which is the Torah Machar Chodesh, right? Yonatan turns to his father and he says, well, what did David ever do to you? Why do you want to kill David? I don't understand. Trying to almost reason with his father and plead with his father. And that's when his father takes his chanit, takes his spear, and tries to spear Yonatan himself. And suddenly Yonatan realizes that this is all for real, and his father really, really wants to kill his best friend, David. Yonatan finally comes to this understanding, and Yonatan runs to David and tells him, listen, David, my father is really truly after you. You really have to run away. And we can read those psukim together in Shmuel Aleph Kaf Gimel 23. Everyone see those? Okay. Vayomer Elav, Yonatan says to David, Al tira ki lo timatzachad yad Shaul avi, my father will never find you. Va'ata timlochal Yisrael, and you are going to eventually be the king of Israel. V'anochi eyelech al mishneh, and I'm going to stick by you, I'll be your second in command. V'gam Shaul avi yodeaken, and even my father knows this, and that's why he's so scared, and that's why he hates you so much. V'yichretu shnehem brit, and Yonatan and David, they make this brit together, lifnei Hashem. V'yashev David b'charsha, and David stays in his place in the woods. V'yohanatan halach l'beita, and Yonatan goes home, and they separate. And we don't hear anything from Yehonatan, from Perek Kaf Gimel. We don't hear Yehonatan say anything. We don't hear about his relationship with Shaul, about his relationship with David, nothing, until the very, very end of Shmuel Aleph, Perek Lamed Aleph, the very tragic Perek of Shaul's final war against the Plishtim. Uplishtim nilchamim b'Yisrael v'yanusu anshei Yisrael mipnei plishtim v'yiplu chalalim b'har ha-Gilboa. So the people of Israel are losing the war. V'yidbaku plishtim at Shaul v'epanav v'yaku plishtim et Yehonatan v'Avinadav v'Malkishua b'nei Shaul. And finally, in that very tragic war, Yonatan is killed along with Shaul, who's killed a little bit later on, not in these psukim, a little bit later on in that very same war. And so the relationship between Yonatan and Shaul, which continues to be very, very tense. We know that during the war of the Dvash, the Milchemet HaDvash, that the way that it's referred to, that we talked about, where Yonatan disobeys his father, goes against his father, they already had this tense relationship. That tense relationship continues in the way that they both act towards David, in the way that they disagree about their relationship towards David. But then, interestingly enough, Yonatan sends David on his way, and we don't hear anything from Yonatan all the way until the very, very end, where he's ultimately killed alongside his father. And so I think the ultimate question is, it seems like Yonatan in the end somehow reconciled with his father. He stuck by his father until the end and was ultimately killed next to his father, whereas Shimon and Levi, on the other hand, were never able to reconcile with their father. Their father never came to terms with what they did, and ultimately, on their father's deathbed, their father curses them. And even though the relationships both start off very, both of them are very, very tense. Both of them are full of these disagreements. One of them ends in a much more positive way than the other. Okay, did everybody see that? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, possibly. Let's leave that question until a little bit later on, if that's okay. Okay? So what we're going to do now is we'll just go back. That's a great question, though. We're going to go back to the story of Shimon and Levi and Yaakov, the story of Shem. Pardon? Oh, we're just going to go back in our heads, okay, to that story. So just everyone could just remember that story. And it seems clear, some people pointed out that it seems very clear that Shimon and Levi really were fighting for these altruistic reasons. They really were fighting for Hakazonaya said Achotenu. And as Josh pointed out, the Torah allows them to have the last word, right? How could it be, how can we leave it be that our sister is a harlot? We had to get up, we had to do something about this. Nivala Sabi Israel, we had to do something. And Rav Amnon Bazak points out that actually their intentions really did start out very purely. That Shimon and Levi really did see something. Rav Amnon Bazak, excuse me, is a rabbi in Alon Shvut, in Yeshivat Haratzion. And he points out that really Shimon and Levi started out with this ideal, with this idea of really something terrible happens in our family and we have to do something in order to strengthen our family. And he sees that there are actually a number of parallels between the story of Shimon and Levi, the story of Shechem, and the commandment to destroy an Ir Hanidachat. Does everybody know what an Ir Hanidachat is? Does anyone want to explain what it is briefly? Any takers? Yeah, go ahead, Heshi. Right, we have a commandment, an explicit commandment, a responsibility to destroy this city. Excellent. And Rav Amnon Bazak points out that there are several similarities between this commandment to destroy an Ir Hanidachat, to destroy a city that's full of idolaters, and the way that Shimon and Levi went out and destroyed Shechem. Excellent, that's true. But what he's saying, he's looking here at the intention to destroy a nevala, to destroy a city that was so full of evil that it could no longer exist. Okay? And the parallels that he points out, I don't love the parallels that he gives, and I gave them to you in a chart over here. We'll go through them together. But I think that the idea behind those parallels is perhaps interesting and worth considering. Okay? So let's read it together. We're on source number 4, and it's in a chart form. Okay? So first he talks about how in both cases we have something terrible that was done in a city. Okay? And in both cases we also have a case where other people are trying to convince their city to do something. So whereas in the Ir Hanidachat we have the leaders of the city convincing the people of the city to do Avodah Zarah. Says Rav Amnon Bazak, in the story of Shechem, we also have the people of Shechem convincing their people to do a Brit Milah, which actually is kind of a flipped parallel if you really think about it. But okay, now, as I said, we'll take all this with a grain of salt, okay? And another parallel he talks about is that in both cases, there has to be some kind of chakira. There has to be some kind of the group has to come together, a group outside of the city has to come together and decide that, in fact, something terrible has been done in the city. And I have the psukim laid out for you over here. And, in fact, in the story of Shechem, Bnei Yaakov come together as a group And they decide, as we've said before, that a nivalah stabi Israel. Something terrible has been done within Israel. And also in the Ir Hanidacha, v'darashta v'charakta, right? We have to really, really look into the matter and make sure that in the Ir Hanidacha, something terrible has been done. In both cases, both cities are destroyed by sword, lefi charev. Okay, so everybody is killed with a sword, sure. But what's interesting, I think, is where Rav Amram Bazak talks about the differences between the Ir Hanidachat and the story of Shechem. Because in the Ir Hanidachat, and this is the last box in source number 4, in the Ir Hanidachat, it says on the left-hand side of your charts, everyone see that? Haketz haket et yashvei ha'ir ha'hi lefi charev. So everyone has to be killed by sword. Hacharem otan ve'kol asher ba ve'behemta lefi charev. Everything has to be completely destroyed. Ve'kol shlala tikbots el toch rechova v'sarafta ba'esh et ha'ir ve'kol shlala kalil ha'ashem lokecha v'hayta tel olam lo tibane'ot. Okay, so everything has to be destroyed. You're not allowed to take any spoils from the Ir Hanidachat. Nothing can be taken from the Ir Hanidachat. V'lo yidbak biyadcha me'uma. Don't take anything. Min hacherem l'man yashuv Hashem mecharon apa v'natan lecha rachamim v'richamcha v'irbacha kasher nishbal avotecha. So that God will have mercy on you. Okay, so in the case of the Ir Hanidachat, everything has to be destroyed. And you're not, the Torah explicitly talks about how we're not allowed to take any piece of the cherem, very much like what happened in Yericho and what happened in the Ai in the times of Yahshua. We're not allowed to take any piece of the city with us. And says Rav Amnon Bazak, this is where we really see a difference in the way that Shimon and Levi acted. Because even though maybe their intentions started out as very, very noble. They were trying to bring honor to their family by destroying the people of Shechem because of what they did to their sister. In the end, the Torah goes to great lengths to describe all of the way that they plundered the city of Shechem and the way that they went too far. Everybody could see those psukim. After they had finished killing all of the males in the city, it says in Pasuk Kav Zayin on the left-hand side of your chart, Bnei Yaakov ba'u al hachalalim v'yavazu ha'ir asher tim'u achotam. And it goes on. Et son'am v'et karam v'et chamorehem v'et kol asher ba'ir v'et asher ba'sadeh lakachu. V'et kol chelam v'et kol tapam v'et neshehem shavu v'yavazu v'et kol asher ba'bayt. They went in and they just plundered the whole city and they took everything. And says Rav Bazak, that is where they went wrong. They started off with this noble cause. But they let this kind of chilling rampage, they let their excitement and they let their zealousness get to them, and they couldn't stop themselves, and they went and they took from the city, and that's where they should have drawn the line. And actually, the Or HaChaim comments on this fact that we're not allowed to take from the spoils of the city, in the Ir Hanidachat, and the Or HaChaim says very beautifully that the reason we're not allowed to take from the city, I'll read the English to you out loud. He says the intention behind these words is that since God commanded that all the inhabitants of the condemned city be put to death by sword, this act will give rise to a cruel nature in people's hearts. When God commands us to kill somebody, once we start killing, then cruelty is going to enter our hearts. Right? They experience great passion when they kill a person. And the root of the mercy is cut out of them and they become cruel. And so says the Or HaChaim, in order to bring us back down, in order to stop this cruelty from truly entering our hearts, we have to stop ourselves from continuing the cruelty and plundering the city. And instead, we have to stop ourselves and burn everything that's in the city. And this is something that Shimon and Levi were not able to do. They were not able to stop themselves when they really, really should have. After they killed everybody in the city, instead of stopping and walking away, they instead plundered the city. And this perhaps is something that was very, very negative. Sorry, I saw a comment maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. You kill everything. Very nice. Okay, so you're saying, right, you're the... What is that left to do? Okay, so I'm pointing this out to you because even though the parallel seems to be imperfect, like you're saying, right, it's like a parallel that we're probably not so thrilled about. It's not a beautiful parallel. I think that the idea is further reflected in a very, very beautiful Rashi, source number 5, where Rashi comments on the curse or the blessing that Yaakov gives to Shimon and Levi at the very end of Sefer Bereishit. And Rashi says, everybody see source number 5? Shimon v'Levi achim, Rashi says, be'etza achat al Shechem ve'al Yosef. Says Rashi, the way that Shimon and Levi acted in Shechem was not just a one-off situation. This is not the first time, this is not the only time that they acted with such rashness and with such cruelty. We also see these actions in the way that they acted towards Yosef. Very interesting. Listen to what he says. Vayomru ish el achiv, va'ata lechu v'nahargehu. It says that the brothers decided that they should go kill Yosef. Mihem, who were the brothers, right? Who was having this discussion about who should kill Yosef? Im Tamar Reuven or Yehuda, Harei lo hiskimu b'harigato. We know that both Reuven and Yehuda did not agree that Shimon and that Yosef should be killed. Im Tamar Bnei Hashvachot, if you were to say that it was one of the Bnei Hashvachot, lo hayta sin atan shlema, they didn't have complete hatred towards Yosef, Shenemar. Right, Yosef used to help out Bnei Bilha and Bnei Zilpa when they were shepherding. Yisachar and Zvulun would never dare say anything in front of their older brothers, would never give a suggestion in front of their older brothers. Al korchecha Shimon v'Levihem, Shekhar Amavihem Achim. Therefore, the only two brothers left. Whose idea was it to kill Yosef ultimately, says Rashi? Shimon and Levi. And what Rashi is saying is something very fascinating, right? What he's saying is that if we look at the story of Yosef, and we see and we understand perhaps that it was Shimon and Levi whose idea it was to go out and kill Yosef, then retroactively, we can look back at the story of Shechem and understand perhaps what Shimon and Levi's true motivations were in the story of Shechem. Just like in the story of Yosef, they disregarded their father's feelings and they disregarded the way that their father would have felt if they actually went through and killed their brother. At the same time, during the story of Shechem, they disregarded what their father wanted from them, and instead they let their emotions get the better of them, and that resulted in the way that they acted during the story of Shechem. It seems to be that Rashi draws this parallel in their character, their rashness. They always let their emotions get the better of them instead of thinking about how somebody else would have felt instead. And what's interesting is that when we think about models kind of Kibud Av V'Em in the Tanakh in general, of relationships between parents and children, the one person who immediately comes to mind, you're nodding, mommy. Well, yeah. The one person who immediately comes to mind is Esav, right? Everyone knows that Esav was the paradigm. Esav was the person in Tanakh who best exemplified the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. And we think about different examples that the Midrash gives, right? He, or even from the Pshat, maybe draws on the Pshat and how it talks about how Esav knew exactly the foods that he should be preparing for his father. And when his parents were angry at him for marrying these Benot Knan, he went and he got new wives. And he was really, he tried, despite all of his shortcomings, perhaps, he really tries to keep this mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em. But I think that what was most important about the way that Esav keeps the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em comes at Esav's really, really lowest emotional point in his life. If everybody could turn to source number 6 together with me, Okay, and this is when Esav, in this week's Parsha, just realizes that he lost the bracha, just realizes that Yaakov usurped him. He loses the bracha, and it says, Kishmoa Esav et Divrei Aviv, Vayitzak Tzeaka Gdola Umara Ad Me'od, Vayomer La'aviv, Barcheni Gam Ani Avi. And Esav is so distraught, and it says that he moaned and he cried this very, very heartfelt scream. And this is actually reflected in Megillat Esther, right? When Mordechai hears what happened to that, when Mordechai hears what Haman did, that he's going to destroy all the people, it says, Vayizak Zeak Hagdola Umara Me'od. Same here, Vayitzak Tzeak Hagdola Umara. This pain that he felt, it was like a visceral pain. He was so, so distraught. And he asked his father, please bless me also. And a few psukim later, interesting, it says, Vayistom Esav et Yaakov al habracha. Esav hates Yaakov because of the bracha that he took, asher brecha aviv, that his father blessed, that his father gave to him instead. Vayomer Esav belibo, and Esav says in his heart, Yikruvu yimei evel avi, once my father passes away, ve'aharga et Yaakov achi, then I'm going to kill my brother Esav. Yaakov, thank you. And if we think about, especially if we think about the way that we're always taught about Esav in school, that the Midrashic interpretation of Esav is that he is an inborn killer, right? He always goes out and he kills everybody and he's violent. This rings even more, it's even more shocking, really, that Esav, at his lowest emotional point in his life, when he's the most upset, he's still able to see things clearly enough that he's able to put his emotions aside for a certain amount of time and say, I'm going to wait for my father to die, and only then will I kill Yaakov. Once my father's out of the picture, I'm free to do whatever I want. But once my father's still alive, once my father is still knowing what's going on, I can't go ahead and kill Yaakov because I know how upset it's going to make my father. And I think that really, really shows a certain greatness of Esav, to be able to kind of push his own emotions down at the time and in favor of what he knows his father thinks, which is really not something that Shimon and Levi were able to do. And in fact, I found this interesting. When finally Yitzchak does pass away, just one second, when Yitzchak finally does pass away, it says in Parsha Vayishlach, Vayu Yimei Yitzchak Me'at Shana Ushmonim Shana, Vayigva Yisav Vayamat Vayasef Elamav Zaken Ushvayamim, both Esav and Yaakov come to bury Yitzchak. And everyone should be thinking at this point, okay, Yitzchak is dead. This is your chance, Esav. Boom, boom, boom. He's dead. Time to kill Yaakov. And in fact, it's a parsha p'tucha, right? It's an open parsha in the Torah. We don't know what's going to happen. And the next pasuk is, Ve'ele toldot Esav hu Edom. This is the legacy of Esav. Meaning that for all those years, Esav bided his time. He did not, he resisted killing Yaakov. He has an encounter with Yaakov in Parsha Vayishlach. He doesn't kill him. He bides his time, goes to bury Yitzchak along with his brother Yaakov. It's time, he's allowed to kill Yaakov, and instead of killing Yaakov, nothing happens. Ve'ele toldot Esav. This is the legacy of Esav. Because Esav bided his time for such a long time, by the time he was really able to keep the promise to himself and actually carry out those actions, he's no longer interested in doing it. He doesn't do it anymore. And I think that that degree of Kibud Av V'Em is really what ultimately saves Yaakov's life in the end. And it really is a credit to Esav. Ve'ele toldot Esav. This is the legacy of Esav. Sorry, Heshi, you were going to say something. He says it after the fact, right? Right, it's true, but.
Mm-hmm.
Right, true. I mean, right, it's possible. It seems that Yaakov seemed to be very happy with the agreement that he made with Shem about the Brit Milah, and it seemed like he was okay with it. It seems like through his agreement with that, and then his passivity, right, that he wasn't included, that it seems like it was clear to them that they knew that he wouldn't necessarily agree, but especially because he was never able to reconcile what happened at the very, very end, I think you can definitely say that it's something that they should have known. Anyone else? Yes, Ellen, sorry. Rivalry. Right. Beautiful. That's very, very nice. But on the other hand, they weren't really thinking about Kibbutz Av. Right? They weren't thinking at all about what their father thought about the whole thing. Their focus is on Leah. Beautiful. It's possible. Possibly. Yeah.
Because they knew that he was not as assertive, say, as his brother, Esau.
Mm-hmm.
And because Yaakov was concerned about what other people would think, and perhaps the extreme that Shimon and Levi went to was a factor in people being afraid of
right. That's definitely a consequence, kind of, that the Amim around them were scared of them, and that was something that was positive that came out of it. But in terms of the relationship, the personal relationship that they had with Yaakov, you're saying that they knew better than their father what he wanted.
This is the question. How much do you respect your parents?
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Right, definitely. Mm-hmm. Possibly, yes. Possibly, for sure. And the Torah might agree with that for sure. But nonetheless, Yaakov was never able to come to terms with the way that Shimon and Levi acted, right? Despite the fact that maybe that what they did was in many ways correct and it was something that should have been done and there were positive consequences, maybe there was a way that they could have done it that would have allowed some kind of relationship to continue in a positive way with their father, right? Well, he makes a deal with Shem, right? His idea is, we're going to be peaceful. We're going to make a deal with these people. And their idea was, well, that's unacceptable. Shimon and Levi disagreed with that, right? So, that Yaakov knows about the deal.
I mean, does Yaakov know about the deal?
That seems yes, yes. Yeah.
Was it Yaakov made it?
Yeah. He waits for his sons to come home, and then they make the deal. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah, it does seem to be the sons. Right.
Yeah, but does it specifically say that
Right. Right. Yaakov is waiting to see how his sons will react to the whole thing. It seems, you're right, it seems that Yaakov is still passive in the whole making of the deal and in laying out all of the plans. But it seems like Yaakov was kind of waiting for his sons to see what would happen, to see how they would react. You're saying that the whole thing was done without Yaakov. Could be. Those psukim here, but it does seem to be that the deal was actually made by Yaakov's sons. It's true. It's a good point. Yeah.
My question that I was going to ask was if Yaakov himself was involved in making the deal, then they basically make the father out to be a liar or a cheat.
Mm-hmm.
It's much worse even than just that they take matters into their own hands.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're able to do that and get any credit for what they've done. And plus, there's so many questions.
Mm-hmm.
You could also say that what they did was so out of proportion
mm-hmm.
to what, Shem did.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And Yaakov, in his, is it with Yaakov, would be that, put forward the idea of if everybody is circumcised.
Mm-hmm. A harlot, yeah.
He was trying to find a way to kind of like dignify the whole thing and make it that she, she was a proper wife.
Right.
And they kind of, I guess they didn't see it that way, but it wouldn't have been like that the Nevela. It would not have remained, the Nevela the way they made it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, you hear in certain societies, she's described as being a whore.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was raped.
Right.
She's a victim.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that, we're Jews. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to think of a victim.
Mm-hmm.
Who's raped.
Right.
A whore.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't fit well with me.
Their comment, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, at the end.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean,
the father was trying to
dignify the whole situation, yeah. I mean, it does kind of, jive with their personality that, whatever comes to mind they would say. But also at that time period, I don't think that was such a, I think that what you're saying kind of jives with the time period that, people who were, and a woman who was raped, unfortunately, she was often not viewed necessarily as only the victim, but also as possibly that she incited it. Exactly. Okay, sorry, another comment. Yes.
So you've got today, you've still got this.
Yes, that's what Toby was saying, exactly. You have today too. Okay. So so that's take number one on what was going on, what was behind the relationship between Shimon and Levi and Yaakov, okay? On the other hand, we have Yehonatan. We could discuss all these things later. I just want to push forward a little bit, okay? On the other hand, we have Yehonatan. Yehonatan starts off Yehonatan starts off in seemingly a similar way to Shimon and Levi, right? He's also very zealous. He also wants to start a war, despite the fact that it's obvious that he's hiding it from his father. And it says, Ula aviv lo higid, he doesn't tell his father that he's going to start the war. He obviously disrespects his father. He doesn't agree with, his military tactics at all. And despite all of this, somehow Yehonatan ends up alongside his father and ends up being killed alongside his father. And I think that just going back to what we were saying about Shimon and Levi we see in story number one, in the story of Shechem versus Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi acted in a way that we're not 100% sure how to interpret their actions. But then, as Rashi points out later on, when Shimon and Levi are faced with a personal situation, with a situation of how do they treat their brother Yosef, despite the fact that they know how their father is going to act, how their father is going to react to the terrible things that they want to do to their brother Yosef. We see that Yehonatan, in his relationship with David, is very different. Yehonatan obviously loves David very, very, very much. He stands by David. He believes that David is going to be the next king, despite the fact that he knows that Shaul hates David. And so what's interesting about Yehonatan, if everyone could just turn back to their... If everyone could just turn back to their sources, I have to find mine. Where Yehonatan, back in source number 3, thank you. I lost my source. Here it is. Okay, so back in source number 3, the very last source in Pasuk Yud, Perek Kaf Gimel Pasuk Yud Chet, by Yechretu Shnehem Brit Lifnei Hashem, by Yashev David Bechorashav, Yehonatan Halach Leveita. Okay? Yehonatan stays with David and he reassures David, David, you're not going to be killed. But then they part ways. Yehonatan lets David live his life as a vagabond. Yehonatan allows David to run away, yes. He allows him to live, of course. But David really lives the rest of his life, up until the very end of Shmuel Aleph, running away from Shaul. He runs away from Shaul. He has to live with Achish Melech Gad. He has to pretend to be crazy. He has a terrible life, really, up until the end of Shmuel Aleph. And Yehonatan... Halach Leveita, Yonatan goes back to his father. And I think that what's so interesting is that despite the fact that Yonatan very, very much disagrees with the way that his father is treating David, Yonatan realizes there's nothing I can really do to change my father's mind. My father is slowly going crazy. It's my job not to stay with David, who I really love and who I really support. It's my job to go home to my father. The Yehonatan halach lebeita. Yonatan puts his own feelings aside and instead sides with his father, who he very, very strongly disagrees with. And that's why at the very, very end, Yonatan is killed in this battle alongside his father, Shaul. And Yonatan, in our very last source, I think that David really had a certain appreciation for what Yonatan did, had a certain respect for the fact that Yonatan left him, and that Yonatan instead goes back and goes home to his father. David, in his eulogy about Shaul and Yonatan at the beginning of Shmuel Bet, David says a very beautiful line. Everybody sees the very end, Shmuel Bet, Perek Aleph. Pasuk Kaf Gimel, says David, Shaul v'Yehonatan hane'ahavim v'hane'imim b'chayehem u'b'motam lo nifradu. Shaul and Yonatan, they loved each other in their lives, they were loyal to each other in their lives, and in their death, they did not part. In their death, they died together. And I think that David really recognized what Yonatan was doing for his father. I think that David really had a certain amount of respect for the way that Yonatan, in the end, stuck by his father, despite the fact that Yonatan so deeply disagreed with the way that his father was acting. And I mean, I think it's really hard for me to look at myself and say that I would do the same thing. That was a very, very difficult choice, I think, for Yonatan to make. But in the end, David respected it, and in the end, it made for a relationship that Yonatan was able to continue to have with his father. And so, I think if we go all the way back to the Gemara that we were talking about at the beginning, about the lo sateret varav, we're not supposed to disagree with our parents, I'm not really sure that we can say clearly that the Tanakh really sheds light on the halachic aspect of the lo sateret varav. But I think it's clear that it's about that the mitzvah really of kibud av va'em is really about the motivations that are behind our actions, the motivations that are behind the actions and the way that we the way that we're motivated in our relationships towards our parents. And hopefully these stories kind of shed some light on how relationships really can be completely torn apart, or how relationships really between parents really can be held together, hopefully like in the case of Shaul and Yehonatan. So if anyone has any questions, please feel free to comment. But that's really all I have for you tonight. So thank you very much.